Hey everyone, this podcast is part of Story Mode, the podcast network of Gamefully Unemployed. You can support us and gain access to other great exclusive podcasts at patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. That's patreon.com/GAMEFULLY unemployed, which is spelled like it sounds.
Oh, hi everyone.
Hello everyone.
My name is David Bell.
My name is Tom Ryman.
And we just watched Insomnia.
Insomnia.
Mork v. Scarface.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Someone out there just beat a 17-year-old girl to death. Your job is to find him.
Doesn't say in the report that he clipped her nails. He washed her hair.
No mutilation?
Not this time.
He tortures him, makes him do things, and keeps him there for 3 days.
This guy, he crossed the line, and he didn't even blink.
So, it's Thursday.
It is.
Which means this is we just watched Classic. I know we did one Monday, and we're doing another. We're doing another by
listen, people, there's fucking nothing coming out right now, so...
Yes, this is also true.
We're going to be looking back at, some classic films. I don't know.
Yeah. This is brought to you by Joshua Graves, who if you recognize the name, he was also from Mondays.
Indeed.
So thank you, Joshua. Thank you for giving us a long list to go on. And we picked out Loaded Weapon 1 and Insomnia.
Yeah, we zeroed in.
Yeah,
on the two, the clear creams of the crop.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Tom, you said to me you hadn't seen this for a while, right?
I haven't seen this movie in a long time. Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it a little more recently. I guess because he's tends to be divisive.
Oh, this is Christopher Nolan, you mean?
Well, I was going to say, where are you on Christopher Nolan?
I like his movies.
Okay. I think we're pretty much in agreement on Nolan.
Yeah. I allow his movies to work on me.
Exactly. Like, the people who sort of... I wrote a Cracked article about this, is that people seem to treat Christopher Nolan films differently.
Yes.
Than other films. Like, they're like, oh, but there's this plot hole and there's this plot hole. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I think it's because Nolan's directing style is very serious.
Yes.
And his movie plots are very silly.
Yes. He feels like a college professor dictating like a Goosebumps book to you.
Yeah. And he doesn't allow much humor. And so I can see why people would see that and say, like, well, he's not so deep. And it's like, no,
he's not. He's not deep at all.
And I guess if you go into his movies knowing that, you don't care. It's he's a good director. He does these great spectacles that are just really fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I've enjoyed all of his movies. I enjoy them the way I enjoy like a Marvel film. Another thing that you can find a lot of plot holes in.
Yeah. But Insomnia came out before he was known for spectacle films.
That's correct. This is his first film after Memento.
Correct.
It's also the only fiction film that he didn't write. He technically didn't write a documentary that he directed.
He didn't write The Prestige either.
I have him here for The Prestige as
well.
One of
I mean,
the
it's based on a novel.
Oh, yes. But
so,
I should say that he didn't do the screenplay.
Get out
of
my face with that.
Well, it's screenplay. Okay. He didn't get a writing credit.
Sure.
He's credited as writing for The Prestige because did the adapted screenplay.
He did, yeah. And the movie is very different from the book. So, yeah. I'll allow that. But at the same time, I'm going to slap you across the face with my nutsack for saying
for sure.
that.
But I'm not wrong. It's the only movie he directed that didn't do the screenplay for, that he didn't have a writing credit.
Sure.
It's a remake.
Yes.
This movie. I've never seen the original.
It's a Norwegian film, is it not?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's super Norwegian. This, I think this also had significance at the time because I think this came before One Hour Photo.
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, so this was the first Robin Williams as a villain movie.
Yes.
And then the seal was broken and he was breaking into people's houses. Taking naughty pictures.
Taking photographs. It was same year as One Hour Photo.
Same year. That checks out.
Okay.
I remember working at a movie theater during this year. I guess Dunkirk as well. It's hard to tell. It's the only non-Batman film. Well, no, at this point, it doesn't have any significance in his career, I would say.
No.
Because for a while, it felt like the most normal film he did. There's no tricks to it. It's just a crime drama.
No, there's a bit of a twist, but not really. Yeah,
but not really. And so, until Dunkirk, it felt like this was the odd one, because everything else was like had some fucking crazy concept to it.
Right. This is just a murder mystery, and it's not even really a mystery because Robin Williams shows up at about the 50-minute mark and admits to the murder.
Yeah.
So that it becomes
it's not a mystery.
It's a cat and mouse movie.
Yes. It abruptly changes what it is, pretty quickly.
Yeah. At the 50-minute mark, that's when Robin Williams calls and is like, "Hey, I'm the killer."
Is this the last time until The Irishman that Al Pacino acted? I don't mean appeared in a movie. I mean acted in a movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. He's barely acting in this.
He is acting.
I get it. Like, I understand his choice. Like, he's supposed to be this veteran detective who is so disoriented by the fact that night never falls in this town in Alaska that he's just sort of like, like he's just kind of like wandering around. I don't know how to interpret it. Like, it, you could take it as, oh, he's acting, like he's playing the part of a guy that's confused. But at the same time, it's like, well, he's just Al Pacino who just doesn't give a shit.
He does. I think he does a good job at playing it very tired, which, again, isn't probably a stretch for Al Pacino.
No.
But I think it works. I guess he's doing works for the role, I think.
It mostly works.
Okay.
I feel like he's not present for some of the film.
And I think that's the point, right?
I think, well, that may have been the point, but it's also kind of a detriment. Because particularly when this movie hits its second act after he shoots his partner by accident, or maybe not, as we come to find out. There's like nobody to anchor to.
Yeah. Also, I would say he definitely didn't do it on purpose. I think the idea is, I don't know.
He flat out says he doesn't know anymore. And we keep seeing flashes of the incident happen.
I thought
where
that was
he sees him clearly and he doesn't see him clearly. No, I mean, I'm taking it as the unreliable narrator.
Okay, that's fair.
I took it as
he's replaying it, like anytime we get flashes, because there's flashes to things that he never witnessed.
Yeah,
like,
that's
he flashes
true.
To the murder and stuff. So I always thought of that as that just his internal imagination, and so it's him like sort of having this horrible guilt because he did kill a man and by killing him, he made his life easier.
Yes.
But there's this whole question of morality throughout, which is that, is that the better way? Is it better? You know, because the whole thing is that he's being investigated by internal affairs. And if he is proved fallible, then horrible people might go free.
Mm-hmm.
And the question, of course, is breaking the rules worth it? And at the end, you know, he sort of tells Hilary Swank, like, no, don't do it. Don't change anything.
He says, don't lose your way.
Because she finds... Yeah, don't lose your way. So, yeah, I don't... I have another question.
Okay.
Which is, how do you rank this in Nolan films?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Okay. It's hard because his films are, I think with a filmmaker that has a long list of movies, rankings sometimes starts getting silly.
Yeah.
Because like ranking Spielberg films, it's like, well, he makes very different films. Like I can't, like, it's hard to put Schindler's List and Jaws on a list.
Right. Yeah.
Because those are two very different films. And so Nolan's starting to get to that point where it's like, well, he's made Batman films and he's made space films and stuff.
Yeah.
So in terms of personal enjoyment, I guess.
I feel like this is his most human film.
Yeah.
Or at least it's up there. Like, it would be up there with Memento and Interstellar in terms of its humanism.
I kind of want him to do more like this.
Sure, yeah.
Because I think this tests him as a filmmaker more than anything else. Because it's easy when you're doing these big spectacle, practical effects. You're spinning rooms around. You're dropping planes from the air. Mm-hmm. You're recreating war scenes. But when you're just trying to do like a simple thriller, he has less visuals to lean on.
Yes, and he kind
and of... And so it's interesting to watch him knowing what we know now.
Yeah, I feel like he loses his way a little bit in this movie.
Yeah.
In terms of, like I mentioned before, Robin Williams calls Al Pacino at about the 50-minute mark and just admits to being the murderer. And then maybe 10 minutes later, it's the first time we actually see Robin Williams on screen. So it's not... It's not really a mystery. It's more about Al Pacino's internal conflict, but it feels like they come up with a few convoluted reasons why he doesn't just arrest Robin Williams. I mean, the main one, like the main conceit of the film is that Robin Williams saw Al Pacino shoot his partner. So he's like, well, if you arrest me, I'll tell everybody you shot your partner. Now, a normal human being would be like, okay, fine, sure. Like, I shot him by accident. You killed a teenage girl. Like, fuck you. But this movie, like, Al Pacino starts to listen to him a little bit, and he kind of helps him for a little bit, and then sort of immediately rolls on him. And it feels really wonky in terms of a narrative. Like, it feels like they had Al Pacino go along with him for about 20 to 25 minutes just to extend the runtime of the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think a big part of this is, and I because he has no one to talk to about what's happening, we never know what he's up to.
No.
They show a few hints. Like, he goes and he plants the gun.
Yes.
And then he meets him on the boat.
Yes.
And so I figured, okay, well, he's leading him along. To eventually implicate him and make it, and Robin Williams says it later, is like, at that point no one's going to care what I say. Basically, he wanted to implicate him so much that if he was like, well, I saw him shoot his partner, Al Pacino could just be like, that's not true, and that's that, because it's his word against a murderer.
Right.
But then there's stuff, and I think this is an Al Pacino performance problem, is they meet on the ferry, they talk, and then Robin Williams gets off, he, as the ferry is leaving and Al Pacino's on the ferry, he turns and he shows that he has a tape recorder and he's been recording him.
Yes.
And Al Pacino does not react. And
that's
moments...
That's an evergreen statement for this movie.
Yes. And
Al Pacino does not react in this film.
I think that is the issue, and I think... Now I have to go back on saying he did a good job, because I do think it would have been more clear what was happening or what his plans were based on moments like that. Because when he didn't react, I was like, oh, I guess he anticipated that?
Yeah.
Because he's not reacting to it.
He doesn't react to anything.
And that's the issue, is once things start getting really tense, like he has the general state of being an insomniac. Like, of not being able to sleep. He has that general thing down. But then there's nothing else.
But it just seems, like, from a 2020 perspective, it just seems like Al Pacino not giving a shit.
Exactly, because he doesn't react in those scenes.
No,
he gets angry in some scenes, and that's about it.
Right, and it's just, it feels, man, it sucks to say, because I know he was probably trying, with this movie, because this was the first movie Nolan did after Memento, which was a big critical splash. And like,
here's
it's this ensemble mystery with two other Oscar winners. Like, I know he's probably trying in this movie, but like, it comes off like he's not.
I would argue that, yeah, Nolan probably couldn't control Pacino. Nolan's an indie director at this point.
At this point, yes. He has only done Memento and Following at this point.
So Pacino is not going to do much for him. Nolan, I would say, as a director, like, I thought he did a great job at visually depicting the insomnia.
He disorients you. For sure.
Yes. Like, the focusing on little things, the focusing on sound, the way the shots, the flashes in his mind, the way, it, like, when he's, like, looking for him at some points, shots are going, like, sort of quickly by, and you're visually.
The way the shots will go from wide to close, which is kind of a thing that Nolan does, but in this movie, it's effective for the mood.
Yeah, and like, I think it really...
This was also just a real quick aside, this was jarring for anyone who watched Memento and was like, I want to see the director of Memento's next movie. And this movie is so blown out compared to Memento.
Yes.
It's clear Nolan was never the indie director. He was always a big spectacle director. Like, and as soon as he got the budget and the means, he was like, okay, here's where I live. And like, he expanded into his space.
Right.
He has never made another movie that is like Memento.
No, he really
hasn't. As soon as he got out of that, he was like, I am making spectacle films from now on.
I think it mostly lands squarely on Al Pacino not giving enough of a fuck.
Yeah, he's in every scene.
Yeah, the other problem.
We never leave his viewpoint, so it really hinges on his performance.
The other issue, I would say, is that, or at least the thing that like popped out at me watching this time around, is that aside from Al Pacino, but especially Al Pacino, all the cops are just terrible.
Right, they're kind of doofuses.
Yeah, they go to that cabin stakeout, and like the reason it gets fucked up is because what's that thing called?
Well, they forgot to tell him that there was a tunnel beneath the cabin.
Yeah, and then the megaphone, like one of them accidentally sets it off.
Yep.
And it was like, what the fuck, you guys? And then there's like 50 of them staking it out. And I was like, how? That seems like conspicuous, but whatever, that seemed to work. And then like Well, it worked. It got Rob. I was thinking Robin Williams wouldn't have even shown up there. He would have walked near the cabin and been like, oh, there's like 50 cops. I can see them. They're talking very loudly.
Yeah.
Hilary Swank at the end, when she goes to the cabin. She gets sucker punched by Robin Williams.
Yep.
Al Pacino shows up. He's like, he starts fighting Robin Williams. And then she gets involved. And Robin Williams runs away while unarmed, and she stops and for like a minute talks to Al Pacino about how he lied. And I was like, he's not the main concern.
Nope.
Run after Robin Williams, get the suspect, handcuff him, and then do it.
In point of fact, she holds Al Pacino at gunpoint.
Yeah. And it's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Yeah. That doesn't make any
shoot
it doesn't
Robin
make sense
Williams.
For a character.
What the fuck are you doing?
Like, yeah, and he has time to run into another cabin. He leaves the cabin, runs across a dock, and gets a gun and loads it.
Yep.
And it was like, what is happening? Like they could have in the writing, and I wonder if that goes down on the screenplay where it's like in the writing you could have figured out a way for all those things to happen without it happening in a very dumb way.
Yeah. Also, ultimately, Hilary Swank's character is stupid and pointless.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't?
Well, I would say not in terms of...
She represents something the movie wants to say, but they never...
That's what I mean.
They never do the thing. She's just kind of there passively witnessing everything that happens.
Because, well, in terms of making the plot work, catching the killer, all that, yes, she's pointless. But in terms of what the movie is about, she needs to be there because the idea is grizzled old detective and a young enthusiastic detective, and she at the end is going to do the her first cover up essentially for him, and he's like, no, don't go down that path. So that, I mean, that's what the film's supposed to be about, is about this corrupt detective who's cutting corners just to put people in jail and truly believes, like, this is how you have to do it. Like, he says it, he's like, I the jury, they've never seen a child killer before, but I know a child killer, and I knew that guy was a child killer, so I'm gonna plant the evidence to make the jury see that. Like, he's at that point where he's just so sick of going through the process that he's just cutting corners, and now it's all piled up against him.
Yes.
And I think the idea that doesn't come out in his performance is that it's piled up so much that he is under the boot of a serial killer, or of a potential serial killer, of a murderer. And so he's the end result of all this, where it's just like he is about to do something horribly wrong and let someone die because he's built his whole career off of cutting corners. And so it's him looking at her who's about to cut her first corner and saying, no, don't.
Yeah.
And that's the point of her. And I like the idea that she is assigned to finding out about the shooting. And I like the idea that when she's about to close the case on that, fairly early on in the movie, he's like, no, not yet. Keep digging. Like, he encourages her to investigate the murder that he really doesn't want people to investigate.
Yeah.
So there's like this part of him that he's fighting constantly. Like, he's supposed to be a person who's torn between these two ideas. And I think when Robin Williams holds that over him, I think the idea is he's stalling because he honestly doesn't know what he's going to do either. But that's putting a lot on Al Pacino.
Yes.
No, I'm talking about just what was in the text, what was in the screenplay, what was the point of it, and what wasn't coming out in Al Pacino's performance.
Right.
So I think she's supposed to, did Al Pacino ruin this movie?
He might have. Getting to? He might have.
Yeah.
And that's, it sucks to say, because I understand what he's doing from an acting standpoint.
Right.
But it's hard to get invested in a character when the character is not present. And that's the decision he made for his character in this movie was, well, this detective, like, is not getting any sleep, so he's going to be out of it. He's going to be zoned out. He's going to be dazed the whole time. And it just feels like Al Pacino is high and doesn't care. Like, it's like...
Yeah, I did care about the stakes, because it was smart of them to tie him, whether or not he gets caught for shooting his partner, to his previous cases.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does create that moral dilemma.
Yeah.
Because it's like, no, I don't care about Al Pacino in any of this. I don't care if he goes to jail or not. But the idea of, like, yeah, if he goes to jail, all the other stuff he's worked on.
Right.
And he describes a horrific murder, torture and murder
of a child.
Of a child.
Yeah.
That they did a good job, because they couldn't show it. You know, they wanted this movie to start when he enters Alaska and end when he, you know, spoilers, dies.
Yes.
And so, like, it would have been cheesy to show, like, his case right before it or something like
that. Yeah, it would have been dumb. Like, it's better. It's a little mystery box, but not egregiously so, and it works in this movie.
Yeah, it does. Because ultimately he says what's at stake.
Right.
And he says what he had done.
Mm-hmm. And we'd been seeing that too, for like the blood soaking the blood through the fabric.
Right.
We don't know what that is for a while, and we keep getting that until flash.
Until the end.
It's until he tells Maura Tierney, who's the hotel clerk, it's until he tells her about the fact that he planted evidence on the suspected child killer. That's when we see. And that's like maybe, I mean, that's definitely act three, but it's maybe 20 minutes before the end of the movie.
The clerk's an interesting character. I think Yeah, this is a tough movie because now I'm trying to think of it as in the writing perspective, because I think the point of the clerk was that he needed to say out loud what had happened.
Yes.
And they had no one to, for him to say that out loud to. He couldn't say it to Hilary Swank.
No.
He couldn't say it to his partner because his partner was dead. So they needed somebody for him to confess to. And he wasn't. He certainly wasn't going to say it to Robin Williams. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure she serves another purpose than that.
Yeah.
But she kind of, she's out of the movie as soon as that happens, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much the last time we see him. Or her, rather.
Right. So she doesn't have, like, an arc.
No, not at all.
Yeah, she's just sort of there for them to bounce that off of, I feel like.
Yeah.
What would you say about the moral conundrum of this? Is it better for him to cut corners or should it all fall apart?
That's the point. Like, right. I don't think the question is really answerable because the movie presents it like we know Robin Williams is guilty. Right. And we're told by Al Pacino's character, Will Dormer, that this guy that he planted evidence on was guilty. And we're told by his partner, Hap, like Hap's like, yeah, I'm going to cut a deal, but you shouldn't be worried because you're a good cop. They can't find anything on you. So like Al Pacino's been pretty much straight his whole career.
Well, my assumption... Oh, okay. Yeah, so the idea is that he's been straight his whole career, and his partner doesn't realize that he did this, he planted that evidence? Is that why the partner's saying that?
He does, because Al Pacino, after Hap tells him that, Will says, well, you remember this guy. And then his partner's like, well, they're not going to dig that up on you. That guy's a scumbag. They're not going to let him out.
Oh, right. Yeah, he says, like, they also want him in jail.
Yeah, they don't want to let that guy out.
Right.
So, I mean, and that was the part of the goal of this movie was to ask that question, whether or not it's right. And I don't know if I can answer that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because he's essentially choosing between these two things.
Right.
And I think,
go ahead.
Oh, I think the idea, what should have been happening better is him trying to bargain with it to not have to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's the whole idea of planting the gun at Robin Williams' house.
Right. He never bargains. He just sort of avoids it until he stops avoiding it.
He's trying to create a scenario where he can get both, where he can catch Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And they don't question the shooting. And it seems simple enough at first until
right.
Robin Williams says, yeah, I saw what happened.
Yeah.
And so it, yeah.
And then he meets up with Robin Williams after Robin Williams has the interrogation scene where he goes a little off script about what he and Al Pacino had talked about.
Right.
Like he was like, don't mention the boyfriend too much because it'll seem like you're pointing fingers. Just talk about your relationship with the murdered girl. But he starts pointing too many fingers at the boyfriend. And they go off to arrest the boyfriend, and Al Pacino plants the gun. But then after that,
Al Pacino tries to unplant because he realizes, oh, he planted that same gun on the boyfriend.
Yes.
I think where the line got drawn, I think the idea was Al Pacino had his idea of the plan. His idea of the plan was to pretend to go along with Robin Williams and then turn his ass in.
Yes.
And then once... the plan, the problem is emotionally that never came off. You have to read his actions.
Right. It doesn't come off in his performance at all.
And so like, that's why I was saying like, I genuinely didn't know how, if he had been corrupt for a while, because he's so nonchalant about
right.
what's happening.
Yeah.
That I was like, he must be used to doing deals or like
I don't think that's actually the case. It's just,
yeah.
His performance is so weird in this movie.
I'm trying to think of what it needed because I do like, yeah, I like how fucking out of it he is.
I think he just needed to be,
Say again?
I was going to say he just needed to be... it's hard to critique it because, again, I understand completely what he's doing. He's a guy that's totally out of it. But
yeah, but I think intent... It's hard to figure out intent. For, all right, a good example is he's driving the teenage girl.
Yes.
To interrogate her. And he starts to swerve on the other side of the road, and there's a truck coming, and he acts like the truck is in the wrong lane.
Yes.
Now, is he doing that on purpose to unnerve her?
Yes.
Because it does seem like that's what he's doing, but you can't tell because his performance is no different if he was, like, tired.
We get the impression from the very next scene when he pulls up to the
dump. Yes, that he was doing
that
it was
intentional,
her.
Yes. But we don't get that with the rest of his actions. So it's like...
I think that's what it comes down to, is I was never completely confused of what his motives were.
Well...
But I just had to... I couldn't... His performance was so the same throughout that it was about reading the actions. Because you're right, I concluded... Oh, he did that on purpose because he was secretly taking her to the dump.
Yeah.
To interrogate her.
But we don't have that with the other scenes.
Yeah, except for that planting the gun. The gun and, like, sort of chasing him whenever he sees Robin Williams.
Yeah.
I liked that. I like how sometimes... I was hoping, like, when he'd meet at the ferry, he would just chase him again. Like, he's just like a dog seeing a squirrel.
Yes. You just chase Robin Williams when you see him.
Yeah, just anytime
he
sees
him. That's just what you do.
And that extended over to their personal lives, like outside of the movie.
Right, yeah, just
premiere?
Just
he just started chasing him.
Chasing him down Santa Monica Boulevard.
Yeah. But I think the movie leaves... I don't mind a movie that doesn't spell it out, you know?
No, not at all. I just think that Pacino's performance is the biggest problem in the film because it doesn't anchor the film. And that's
right.
That's intentional because he's not anchored. That's the whole point, is that he doesn't have a steady footing at any point in the film.
Right. It does seem like there's a decline. Like at the beginning when he's gotten sleep, when he first gets there, he does seem like a different person. Like he's definitely doing a thing where depending on which scene you see him in, his performance is different based on how little sleep he's gotten or how long he's gotten without any sleep.
I think it needed to be more dramatic or more pronounced because the difference between the first day of him not getting any sleep and then the last scene where he dies, I can't tell the difference. He seems like the same character. I guess
more emotional would have helped, but he definitely seemed less and less with it. Like they were doing stuff like when, and maybe part of this is the editing as well, is like when he's having beers when they think they caught the guy at the end.
Yeah.
He's just like staring blankly.
Right.
And
he's staring
mumbling
into space. Yeah.
And he's mumbling and he's not making any sense.
Yeah.
Near the end when he's talking to Robin Williams, he's like, he can't get names right. And he's like he becomes very disoriented by the
end. Yeah, that's true. He does say, in that final confrontation, he does say, "You killed Hap," or something like that. Like he mixes
all the names up,
the names and the actions up. Yeah,
and I like that idea. I like the idea that on a good day, Al Pacino could have immediately fucking ripped Robin Williams to shreds.
Right, and of course he would. He's a career detective. Yeah. And this guy's just a fucking clown shoe crime novelist that lives in Alaska.
Right, but since he's so fucking
exhausted.
Yeah. What do you think the significance... I don't know if there's much significance of Alaska, because this was originally a Norwegian film, and I don't know how different it is, but I assume it had to do with the sun never setting.
Yeah. I mean, the original film is also called Insomnia, and it's the same gimmick.
The symbolism is the idea that he did this thing, and it's never... The light is always shining on him.
Correct.
He can't escape. Block it out.
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
He can't escape the light.
And then there's the Alaska thing. I'm just wondering if in Norway there's a cultural equivalent of this, is they talk about how there's two types of people in Alaska, people who are born here, people who are running away from things, which whether or not that's true about Alaska, to people who don't live in Alaska, that's, I think, what we assume Alaska is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's part of it, too, I feel like, is that he's been sent to Alaska to run away from something.
Yeah.
He feels guilty. The moment when he's already there, he feels guilty, which is why he can't sleep right away, I think, right?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, symbolically, yes. The light's constantly shining on him, and he can't escape it.
And you could argue that the purpose of the clerk is that she's forgiveness, because she actually, when she's talking to him, when he tells her everything, she's standing in front of the window. She's blocking the light.
Yeah.
So the idea is that she's sort of representing that. She doesn't really help him.
No, not at all. She's his confessional.
Yeah. What does she say to it? Because he asks her what she thinks. And she says something like, I guess it depends on you or on the person.
Yeah, something like that.
Which is sort of, I guess, the point. What you were saying is that it's the question can't be answered.
Right. She doesn't pass judgment on him, and she's wearing a very prominent crucifix.
Yeah.
So I think she is just literally his confessional.
Right.
And she doesn't judge him. She just hears him, and she's like, well, I mean, I can't say whether what you did was right or wrong. Like, that's an individual choice that we have to make.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. It's interesting. It's wicked deep.
Yeah. It's super deep, bro.
It's wicked deep, Tom.
Super, super deep, bro.
Yeah. The, him firing the gun in the middle of the town is funny, right?
Yeah, shooting the dead dog.
Yeah. I get why he had to do it, because he needed a body to shoot the bullet in.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, when he goes, again, it's terrible cop stuff. Terrible cop stuff.
Yes.
He knows, he's walking down literally the center of the road.
Yeah, he's walking down Main Street.
Yeah. And it's like, dude, isn't this supposed to be like a secret thing? And I get that it's supposed to be night. And so, like, it's technically him in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, people exist at night.
Yeah.
Like, people will see that shit. There might be, like, bank cameras and stuff like that. Like, it's not... And, like, I guess it implies that he has to go where the dog is, because that's where... Because you can't just fire it into... Like, because it's Alaska. There's so many places to fire a gun that's not in the middle of a town.
Yeah, just shoot like a fucking swordfish. Like, who cares?
Right. That's more work. I was thinking, like, put the dog in, a pillowcase and bring it somewhere that you can shoot it.
Oh, yeah. That's an option as well.
Yeah, and so you don't have to create a new dead body. But... I like that the movie just assumes that, you know, it's Alaska. If someone fires a gun in the middle of a town, people aren't going to turn their
heads. Nobody's going to turn their head. It's Alaska.
Yeah.
It's the ends of the fucking earth.
Yeah, I imagine there's a lot of gun shooting in Alaska.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing else to do.
Yeah, you just got to shoot your guns.
Just going to shoot a gun.
But yeah, that was a weird choice.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't bother me too much, but him walking, like if they had just showed him being more sneaky. Like in the scenes, that's right.
He just stumbles into the same alley where you'd piss if you were too drunk, and then
his
just shoots a dog.
Sneakiness is interesting because there's really only one part where he has to be sneaky, or two, I guess, just one part, and it makes sense where he's trying to unplant the gun in the kid's house and he can't find it, and then he has to pretend to walk in, but he also has to switch the bullet. Mm-hmm. But he can just sort of do that. They're also sort of showing how easy it is to manipulate things if you're a cop.
Yeah, how easy it is to shoot a dead dog.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can shoot all
you
the dead dogs you want.
You can just do whatever you want. Nobody's going to stop you.
Yeah, it's police plus you're in Alaska, so double no one's going to stop you. Because it's like, man, everybody's so cold. What does it matter?
Yeah, why would they bother? It's Alaska. Nothing's going on.
Yeah.
How dare you? How dare you try to stop this man from shooting a dog?
And I guess I want to circle back around now, because do you have any other general thoughts about this movie?
No.
Okay. Because what's interesting, and I said this, we talked about this with Nolan, is that despite all the little problems, I enjoy this movie.
Yeah.
None of what we talked about stops me from enjoying this movie.
No, it's a good movie.
And I think that's almost completely on Nolan, right? Nolan's choices to cast Robin Williams to do interesting things in the filmmaking to make it look as pretty as it does.
Yes, I mean, definitely. Like I mentioned at the beginning, this was the first movie. This looks very much like a typical Nolan movie now, but this was the first taste we got of that.
Yeah.
So if you had watched Memento and went into Insomnia being like, oh, it's the director of Memento, you'd have got kicked in the balls by this movie's cinematography, because it's like, this is way blown out. Like, he really... it's Wally Pfister again, who was his DP for a very long time up through Inception, I believe.
Right.
But he really shows off the Alaskan landscapes, like stuff that's very familiar from The Dark Knight and Inception and Interstellar, where it's just showing off these sort of isolated but very picturesque landscapes that are inhospitable but still like very picturesque.
Right.
He does a lot of that in this movie. And he switches back and forth between showing you these huge wide shots and then these very claustrophobic shots where it's indoors with Al Pacino fighting the sunlight, or it's Al Pacino interrogating somebody, or it's Al Pacino being faced with evidence that he has to sort of deny or gloss over. And that's all very intentional. The jarring move from these wide open landscapes to these incredibly claustrophobic moments. And just the filmmaking of this movie is very, very good.
Yeah. It almost feels like the things that were the most, that had the most problems are the things that Nolan had the least control over.
Right.
The screenplay he didn't write.
No.
Not to say he's an amazing writer, but he didn't write this. And Al Pacino is, I imagine, hard to handle.
Particularly
when you're
for
an indie director.
Yeah, particularly for Chris Nolan at this point.
Yeah.
Like Chris Nolan could probably direct Al Pacino now in 2020, but
yeah,
not in 2002.
He also, most of his actors are all very rigid. They're very stiff.
Yes. He doesn't
like, I don't think he directs actors that well.
No, he doesn't. He truly doesn't.
I think he picks the right actors to do the job.
Right.
And then,
I mean, the only,
and then they do the thing.
The only actor that has been amazing in a Chris Nolan movie is Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Like, everybody else is just very much...
Right. And I think, again, that was... I think Christopher Nolan gets zero credit for
right,
that.
Right, no, I think that's all Heath.
Heath Ledger
it's
was
clearly,
just like...
Right, it's clearly all Heath, because if you look at all the other performances in that film, and then all the other performances in every other Nolan movie, they're all very similar.
Yeah,
He's not terribly interested in the performance.
No.
Like, he's interested in the scope and spectacle and the story.
Yes. Is he... This is an interesting question. Because I'm not sure it's... does Christopher Nolan do mystery boxes? I know that sounds like a dumb question.
Not really.
He doesn't, right?
No.
And I think there's going to be some people who are like, are you crazy? Of course he does. But
it
depends on your definition of what a mystery box is. And I think this is why
leading up to the film, he does. Nobody knew what the fuck Inception was about.
Oh, that's great.
But
I love that.
But in the first 10 minutes, you know what Inception is about.
Yes. And
I think Tenet is going to be the same thing.
Yeah, I think we might have to define mystery box so people understand that, though.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of... Because, like, his brother certainly does mystery box.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
With Westworld.
Westworld's
and, like, what
one
makes,
of the kings of mystery boxes.
Yeah, and what makes a difference is that there's definitely mysteries... In his movies, The Prestige, there's literally a what's in the box. Like, there's a box.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. But what it is that we know what the specific characters know.
We know what the mechanisms are.
Yes, that's the big thing, is we know what the rules are and what the fuck is happening.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with a mystery.
A mystery box withholds that information from you. Like,
yes,
if you're listening and you're not familiar with the term, a mystery box is when the show or movie just sort of randomly withholds information from you that all of the other characters on screen know, just
to make it feel more special.
Correct. Just for the sake of creating a cliffhanger or a mystery or a hook to keep you engaged.
Yeah. I would argue that it's not even, sometimes it withholds it from the other characters, but it's not logical why. For example, when Anthony Hopkins in Westworld in the first season is creating a new attraction and there's all this construction, all the characters are like, what is he doing? And it's like, surely somebody knows, right? He's not operating that construction equipment.
Right.
Like, it doesn't make sense for people not to know. Correct. So it's being withheld illogically.
Yeah.
And it was coined by J.J. Abrams, and I love the analogy because he was talking about how he was at a magic shop when he was a kid, and the magic shop would sell these mystery boxes, and the idea is for $15 or something, you buy this box and you don't know what's in it. And he gave the TED Talk saying, like, it's not what's in the box, it's the mystery of the box. And what was hilarious is that New York Times then tracked down those mystery boxes, like on eBay or at the actual store he referred to, and found that they were full of cheap crap.
Yeah.
Like stuff that wasn't worth the $15. And that's really what it is. It's selling something cheap a bigger price because you've wrapped it in a mystery.
Yeah, artificial mystique. Mystique that you have created.
And I don't think Nolan does that.
No, he really doesn't.
I think the biggest one is The Prestige, but the magic shop comparison, The Prestige is kind of about that.
The Prestige is about...
The whole thing is...
The Prestige.
Yes.
Like, it's a stage of a magic trick. Like, it's about the fact that you don't know what the final stage of this magic trick is. And the rest of his films, as heady and fucking weird as they are conceptually, and as little as they tell us about it leading up to the movie, like with Inception and Interstellar and now with Tenet, like we really don't know entirely what these movies are about based on the trailer because they don't divulge much information. Once those movies start, you know what the fuck they're about.
Yeah.
He doesn't hide it, and he doesn't make figuring out what the movie is about the mystery of the movie.
Yes. Which is, very irritating. Or figuring out basic information.
Correct.
Like character backstories, stuff like that. It's not the draw of it.
No.
And it's different than a twist. A twist would be something you don't see coming. I would argue there's of course, criticism of The Prestige, which spoilers. I guess I won't spoil it, but the reveal of how Christian Bale's doing his trick, people will argue, doesn't make sense. I would actually argue that
it does a lot of work to make it make sense.
Yes. Because, okay, spoilers for The Prestige.
Yeah.
The reveal is that he's a twin. He has a twin. He's always had a twin.
And Michael Caine calls it immediately. Like at the halfway point, when Hugh Jackman sees this magic trick, the transported man that Christian Bale is doing, Michael Caine comes back and he says, he has a double. That's the only way he can do it. And Hugh Jackman just won't accept it. And that's part of the point of that movie.
Yeah, it's funny because, that's a big part of how magic tricks are works is that you don't accept the obvious because it's like, well, that's not clever.
That's not magical. It's like, no, it's not. He's got a fucking twin.
it's a lie.
And and that's the whole point of The Prestige is that the obsession and like he will not accept that it's that simple.
The thing that people always call the movie out for is they're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. That means his twin has been living this life with him forever. I think even Cracked probably pointed that out as a plot hole.
Yeah, but he says that in the beginning.
Yeah, and well, also the idea is they show the guy, and this was based off a real magician, who pretended to be an old Asian man.
That's the scene I was talking about, where it's like in the first 20 minutes, Christian Bale's like, that's the magic trick right there, is the fact that this guy in his public life is committed to the kayfabe of this, essentially, to make his magic trick work. So yes, he and his twin have been living as a single person.
Since when he first became into magic.
Right.
You can argue that, when they first met Christian Bale, they did, And I think that's also why, it's not just why, but why it helps that the movie takes place long ago when you could sort of you could get away with a person not existing. I think that works perfectly.
The movie does enough work.
It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't.
When
work.
You when you watch it a second time, you're like, oh, it's clearly two guys. Like,
yeah, and it's proposing the idea that yes, this person committed to this idea for a very long time.
It was hellish for them. He cuts off one of his own fingers.
Yep.
To match his brother.
Yeah, it's again that whole movie's about obsession because there's also his obsession.
It fucking drives his wife to suicide. Like it's the movie is about obsession.
Yeah. But this isn't the prestige.
This is
cast.
Not the prestige cast.
I do want to note that magician that the old Asian man was based off. First of all, wasn't Asian.
No,
It was a guy in yellow face pretending to be an old Asian man.
Of course, they all were. They all were
and
back then.
And legend goes that he died doing the bullet catch trick, which is supposedly one of the most dangerous magic tricks to ever do. He was shot, and his last words was saying, "Oh God, I've been shot," in English, which is very funny to
That's
me.
Amazing,
because it means that he basically had been putting on this act all the way until he suddenly got shot and then he dropped dead and everybody's like, wait, did he just speak English? And then it just all comes falling apart. I don't know how true that is. It's I've sourced it before, but it's a very funny story.
The way the movie presents it, presents the bullet catch trick specifically, feels like it's probably true. Because it could just be any asshole.
Oh yeah, they do the bullet catch in that, don't they?
Putting a button or a penny into the gun.
Yeah.
Just to be like, yeah, fuck this guy.
Right.
There were no rules back then.
Yeah, there's a bunch of ways that can go wrong, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, the prestige. Going back to Nolan.
Nolan is way more about the story. He's not about tricks. He's about where the story goes, and that means he's more,
I think he is about tricks, but he knows that the best tricks aren't the ones that feel cheap. The mystery box is a cheap trick.
Right. I think he does. It's hard to.
He's always done twists well because, and he not all of his movies have twists.
Few of them do. Most of his movies just have these elaborate unfolding plots that happen.
Yeah.
And where he gets his most criticism from is how robotic and alien his characters seem.
Yeah.
Because he cares about the story. He doesn't care about the characters. Like, the characters serve the story and not vice versa for Nolan.
I would say that's extremely fair criticism. I would also say it's fair criticism to point out that his movies, the plots are silly.
They are.
Or they probably don't all make sense. Like, the logic of how the sci-fi premises work don't make sense.
But he executes them so well that when you're watching the movie, you do not realize that.
Yeah, or you don't care.
Or you just don't care.
The other thing is that I would argue that saying, oh, the dream, the Inception dream thing doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but who gives a shit?
To me, it's like, well, it's like pointing out that the Iron Man suit doesn't make sense.
Or right, or like pointing, or like watching the T-Rex attack in Jurassic Park and being like, dinosaurs don't exist right now.
Yeah,
it's like I don't care because this is awesome.
Like, yeah, it's like cool. It's techno magic.
Yeah,
it's bullshit. It's complete bullshit.
I don't care. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, his movies aren't so elevated that he's not like Alex Garland where he asks more mindfucky questions.
No, he's like a Spielberg, except his plots are a little more heady.
Yes.
So I think that people elevate them just on principle to be like, oh, a Chris Nolan movie means it's going to mean something. No, it doesn't. It's just dumb popcorn movie.
Like, everything he's doing serves one idea, which is every idea he elaborately puts together in a movie, I think ends with him going, and wouldn't that look cool?
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's it. It's just like, it's not a thought process. It's not, and doesn't that blow your mind? It's like, no, but in all of that bullshit I just made up can result in a bunch of people flipping around in a hallway.
Yeah. What if,
and it's like, cool.
All of that dream nonsense I told you resulted in Tom Hardy shooting people on a snowmobile?
Exactly.
They'd be like, $200 million. Here you go.
Yeah.
Christopher
and
Nolan.
That's really, I think that's what it comes down to with Nolan, is that he's making just the same Hollywood films as everybody else, but at least he's like creating very elaborate bullshit for it to happen. He still has gunfights. He still has ridiculous like action moments.
Yeah, no, he just,
and stupid plot points. He's just being way more creative about how to make those stupid things work.
Yeah. And he tells it in a way that we're glued to the seat until it unfolds.
Right. All that said, I'd love for him to go back to something like this, to Insomnia, to simplify. And I guess Dunkirk is that, because Dunkirk is very no plot gimmicks. It's just, I'm going to tell this story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think he is very good at that. Or at least I really enjoyed Dunkirk, and I enjoy this film. So, I don't know. I wouldn't mind more of that.
Sure.
But at the same time, I want to see what the fuck's going on with Tenet.
Yeah. Got to see Tenet.
Yeah.
Need to know what that is.
Want to see what crazy practical effect he puts in that. I think I know what it is, but
we've already
I'm not
talked about
say
what it
anything.
Is, right?
Not, I don't think we've recorded ourselves.
Okay.
I at least think I know what the practical, what the gimmick is, what the gimmick's going to be. Or what the visual gimmick, not why the visual gimmick exists, just what the gimmick's going to be. And the trailer kind of shows it too. It has to do with time. He's going to fuck with time. This is going to be his time travel.
He's just shooting things in reverse.
Has he done time travel yet?
No.
Okay. I think this is going to be his time travel film.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to use time travel to do cool visual stuff as opposed to pose any extreme questions.
Yes.
Again, it's him going to be like, so what if time travel was like this and this and this? Wouldn't that look cool? Like, that's what it's going to be.
And we're all going to be like, yes, it does look cool.
Yes, that really does look cool. Good job.
It does, Chris Nolan. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's it.
That's it. Right? That's all I've got.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot.
We did.
Not necessarily about Insomnia.
We said several words.
Yeah. So I want to thank Joshua Graves, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Joshua Graves. I want to thank you for your support, and I want to thank you all for your support and to listen in the act of listening. That's what it is. Thanks for hearing our voices for a full hour.
Indeed.
Yeah, and not shutting it off.
No. Thanks for keeping it on this whole time.
If you're interested, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We have exclusive podcasts there, like Tom and Jeff Watch Batman and Fox Mulder is a Maniac.
Mm.
And we have tiers where you can produce your own We Just Watched, where you force us to watch something like Insomnia, although it wasn't hard to force me to watch this.
No.
Yeah.
And we also have a store at tpublic.com/store/gamefullyunemployed where you can get stickers, t-shirts, masks. If you order masks right now, TeePublic will donate a mask.
Not like Frankenstein masks.
No.
I wish we could sell like Frankenstein masks. Man, or if, like rubber masks.
If we could sell like Mike Myers masks. Michael Myers.
Or just masks of ourselves.
Indeed. Yeah, oh yeah.
Like if
just,
we could
just flesh mask of my face.
What does it take to make a custom mask? Do you think that's easy?
I don't know.
Is there a TeePublic for masks?
I hope so.
I might look into that. Someone look into that for me.
Yes. Somebody find the answer to that question.
Yes.
And let us know.
Yes.